flavors and items from everybody's past. And I'll give you one as a Brooklynite you'll appreciate. There is the mania to try to recreate Ebinger's blackout chocolate cake.
Oh, yeah. That is so true.
And I know that, you know, there was a huge elaborate article actually about it in either Bon Appetit or it might have been online in like the New Yorker. Somebody that, but there was a lot going on to try to recreate it. And for those of you that don't know, it was a really dense chocolate cake, dense in flavor, not in texture. The texture was light and airy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And of course, the green box, the green Ebinger's box that we all grew up with. I boy, that now you're gonna make me bring up a bunch of silly things.
It's similar with the cheesecake too, Junior's cheesecake from Brooklyn. You
well,
know?
You can still get Junior's though. You can
still get it. Yeah, exactly.
You can call my friend Alan Rosen and Michael Goodman, cake stylists that have been making Juniors for years. Sign up for Juniors Cheesecake of the Month Club.
Yeah,
and they'll get one every month delivered right to the house. So I'll let
it's
out.
A beech nut gum.
Oh my God, beech nut! That's a good one. Here's another New York item that I don't understand. A brand name that is a natural to bring back, and I don't know why it's gone. The coffee ice cream flavor from Schraff's,
yeah,
and those pristine white pints of Schraff's with the red lettering, and I mean the Schraff's brand itself. I mean Schraff's was such a as a kid, Schraff's was a real quality, iconic brand, and it's
exactly
completely disappeared. I don't understand why, you know. But the coffee ice cream of Schraff's is my white whale. And to bring this upstate, I've discussed this, I think, once or twice. The meatballs at a restaurant on East Lodi in Syracuse called Caroma. I've talked about Caroma before. Italian family, after 50 years, they just walked away. They said, you know what? We've had enough. The grandmother was like 95 that would make the famous lasagna. Their meatball... I've tried so hard to recreate the texture.
Yeah.
Not so much the even the flavor, but the texture. It was it just magical.
That's really fantastic.
So a quick review of these amusement parks, because I put up the images of Santa's Land in Putney, Vermont, which I can remember as a kid, and of course Storyville, now Great Escape at Lake George. Playland Rye. You must have gone up to Playland once or twice, of course, right? Brought the boys. Palisades. Now, the Palisades was gone by 70, 71. So you and I, you know, would have both been 10 years old, 11 years old.
Right.
Never got to Palisades. Kitty City has come up in Douglaston, Great Neck. Kitty City, right by the Cross Island, right off the Cross Island. The first response I got was from Michael Bacek, who brought up a place in Baton Rouge. And that's what's so cool about this. He brought up a joint called Funfair Park, and he had a picture of the wild mouse. And that tripped other people talking about a wild mouse children's roller coaster at their favorite place. This just kept unspooling in different directions, and people. Freedom Land. How about this? Did you remember this at all, Sid? That there was that amusement park where they built Co-op City.
Yeah, yes, I do.
I remember driving by. On 95 on the way from Great Neck as a kid. You know, when we moved to Connecticut and we'd go to see my grandparents. I had completely forgotten that there was an amusement park.
That's a blast from the past.
Right?
Yeah.
Freedom Land. Unbelievable. From up here at Saratoga.
Coney Island never came up, did it?
Well, Steeplechase Park. They had one Steeplechase Park and one Nellie Bly Park reference.
Nellie Bly, yep.
It's amazing. I mentioned that for years when I was at Colgate, I would go by, if I drove from Hamilton to Syracuse, I would go by the former Manlius Academy. And that there was the remnants of an amusement park across the street from the academy, and that provoked a bunch of people. It was called Suburban Park, and it apparently had been around since like the 1840s. And then the Manlius Academy, Scott Wyckoff from WBAL Baltimore, his father went to Manlius Academy, the military school. This is so fun. I mean, it's just crazy. I should really, I don't do this enough, go through the emails. I've got 10 or 11 emails to answer about this. People talked about Kaidaros Park out by the lake here, you know, Saratoga. Craziness. David Hill, he talked about the Magic Springs Dog Patch USA in Arkansas, where they would go as kids. And
he wrote that book, right?
Yes, he wrote The Vapors.
Yeah. Right.
Sherry Ross, the well-known, early and prominent female sports writer, a place I'd never had heard of called Bertrand Island at Lake Hoptakong, New Jersey. Never heard of it. Craziness. How about Excelsior Amusement Park in Minnesota, the Canterbury team. Jeff Madej popped that one out. I mean, Bobio Island Amusement Park, Boblo Island, an amusement park out like off a pier. Craziness. I mean, a lot of fun.
Oh, what a great trek that was.
And there's been a few added this morning that I haven't even seen yet.
You know, you can tie these into with a lot of the fair tracks.
Yes.
In Massachusetts were really, you know, great food and amusement parks outside the racing, you know.
There's been another 10 this morning that I hadn't even seen yet. Gaslight Village up at Lake George. That's a good one. Myrtle Beach Pavilion at Myrtle Beach. Rogue Wolf with that one. How about the Pike in Long Beach? Here's another Gaslight Village. The Danbury State Fair. You know what? Bob Shanley, the great Danbury State Fair. That actually is a good one I grew up with in Connecticut. Mountain Park in Holyoke. You've got to be kidding. Oh, my God. Another place I'd forgotten about. There's a place in Connecticut, too. Lake Compounds we used to go to. I'd forgotten about. Lake Compounds. It's very funny.
And they're all relics from the past.
Yeah, so they are.
There's a certain age to the commenters.
That's true. I think that's true. My cousin was listening, and she brought up going to that crazy action park, or as they called it, class action suit park, that had the dangerous, you know, the terrible, you know.
Yeah.
They would drag them off to area hospitals daily. If you haven't seen that documentary, it's unbelievable. In fact, the documentary itself is on YouTube. Anyway, so thanks to everybody that's responded, and something tells me this is going to be like the donut thread that went on for about 10 days. And that people kept discovering. And I didn't mention Jay Hovde, who grew up in Anaheim. Hovde said, and here's a Disneyland reference, he said out their kitchen window they could see the nightly fireworks show at Disneyland. And he also lived in the other direction was Knott's Berry Farm, which I remember. I remember going to, my parents took me to Knott's Berry Farm with my and we went to a place in California with birds.
With birds?
Yeah, with birds. Like, you know, like Remember, what was it? Parrot Jungle? Parrot? Where was the parrot? Where was Parrot Jungle? I remember going to a parrot thing where they you'd walk around and you know, there'd be people with parrots all over the place, and you could they put them on your shoulder and they hold them on your finger. And I mean, today, you know, today people would be losing fingers left and right. Parrots would be snapping off phalanges. So thanks to everybody for that has gotten a kick out of this, and on Sylvan Beach too. Sylvan Beach, I had to mention our friend Todd Engel said, "What about Sylvan Beach?" I put up some pictures from I took Tina there. We were during like right either at the beginning before it opened that season or right after it closed, and it's really a great place to bring children just outside of Syracuse.
You should really think about a project down the road, Americana Nostalgia.
I like it. I'm a sucker for that stuff. That's why the Route 66 trip was magical. I got to see.
Yeah, you and I both did that. I did that on my bike.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, because that really, that is the. Probably it's the mother road of nostalgic tourism.
Did I tell you that, you know, on one of my stops on that trip, I think it was through Oklahoma, there was a hot dog stand, and I mean, it was the chili dog was circa 1966.
I love it. Well, that's the Oklahoma. Oklahoma is as fascinating. It's as fascinating a state as we've got, honestly. And having lived in Kansas City,
I agree totally.
Right?
Yeah.
When I lived in Kansas City, I used to have to go down to Tulsa and make sales calls. They had a division of Cisco, and used to stay. At the Camelot Inn, which I think was on, I can never remember if it was Yale Boulevard or Harvard Boulevard, but there's Yale and Harvard are key roads. And I was fascinated by Tulsa, period. And it's funny, this comes up today on the anniversary of the start of the massacre at Greenwood in Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
But when we came through on Route 66, I discovered things that I just could not believe, including a lake, this gigantic lake. In fact, I texted Blasey about it, and he grew up just north of that lake, almost on the Kansas border. And it's like a Lake of the Ozarks kind of a sprawling thing with hundreds, like literally hundreds of miles of coastline in the middle, not in the middle, it's in the northeast corner.
Northeast corner?
Northeast corner of Oklahoma.
So that's near like Miami.
That sounds right. And we discovered all kinds of stuff. Well, we stopped
including
to see
that ghost town that, you know, we talked about, the town that had to be completely cordoned off.
Yes.
With the gorilla
statue that I discovered.
Right.
I want to say Pichter, Pichter, that produced all the lead for the munitions in World War One. That's a crazy story. That was all. Well, that and also commerce. The Mickey Mantle.
Yeah,
I saw Mickey. When I tell you,
I went there. I went there too.
That was amazing. The little house that he grew up in.
Yeah, exactly.
I found a marker also in Oklahoma. Found a marker from the hometown of a young, like a 16-year-old boy that won the transatlantic foot race in like 1923 or something. I should dig that up. I haven't told that story. There was one old gas station that had long been closed. There's nothing town, and a young high school athlete won a race coast to coast on foot.
Wow.
And wasn't even aware there was a transatlantic foot race. I mean, you can't... this was all in Oklahoma. I and then of course there's,
yeah, I know.
then there's the onion burger. The onion burgers, yeah. which are unbelievable. I could go on and on. I'm a big Oklahoma fan.
Yeah, me too.
The town El Reno is where the famed onion burger started. But I found that place, that Nick's in Oklahoma City, that was unbelievable. A little bit of a thicker onion burger. All right, we've managed to exhaust the non-racing topic, and frankly, we need as much fresh, you know, uplifting material as possible during about as trying a period as we've had in recent memory. Sid, the question, and if you, I assume you saw. The Earl of Max piece.
Yeah, I did see it. And, you know, to address your question, it's a real paradox because stud farms and breeding farms want dirt racing. And, you know, this is a call to abolish all that, which would be, you know, such a controversy among Lexington breeders and stud farms, because the entire business, both in Lexington and globally, is built on the attraction of stallions proven on dirt and mares that raced on dirt. These are the horses that are Kentucky's most valuable and the United States' most valuable export commodity, as well as a domestic commodity. These are the horses that are, you know, held in the highest esteem. And we saw this when there was the move towards all-weather tracks. You know, you listed so many of them. I'm just going to call them all-weather tracks.
Sure.
There was a real fight to get dirt back. And, you know, what Earl's calling for right now is just going to reignite that entire debate again, because it all boils down to, you know, commerce. Now, dirt racing, he's absolutely right. And everybody knows this, dirt racing. And it's why the American dirt horse is so much in demand, because dirt racing is the most toughest, most brutal racing sport. People ask why Lasix is not used anywhere around the world, but it is here. Dirt racing creates all sorts of issues. One is it's a tough surface to run on. It's a speed game. Horses run hard out of the gate. It's not like in Europe where you brake slowly and you finish quickly.
Right.
And you're racing on a forgiving surface. This is a surface where horses that can scale the heights of the Triple Crown races and whatnot and do it on dirt, they're held in the highest esteem. These are the horses that, you know, people pay millions of dollars for. Stud farms, so forth. And these are the horses that translate as exports to other countries where they become really successful because they've proven themselves in the harshest environments. And so if this were to be taken out, it would create major controversy in the bloodstock capital of the world, for sure. Now, Earl Mack is right. The stats don't lie in terms of fatalities. all-weather surfaces are much safer. And even Churchill's own Turfway will point out that contrast in fatalities. So it's something the industry is going to have to deal with. And it's interesting, you know, Belmont's coming up. They're building a all-weather surface. And I thought that Aeromax, I thought the Aeromax call for Churchill Downs was kind of interesting, because he wants the Derby to be on all-weather and he wants an entire track to be on all-weather. And, you know, something that Churchill certainly was not one of those tracks that did go to all weather when the flavor was there. Keeneland did for a while, obviously. They were part owners of the company that the all weather company that did install those tracks. But Churchill has been steadfastly against that. Now, the interesting thing also, Steve, is, you know, Churchill's support of Heise really helped the bill get through. And I find it kind of amusing that if Heise were to actually issue a dictum to Churchill to stop racing right now, the bill that they wanted, the organization Heise that they supported, what if that organization were to tell them to stop racing? I mean, there's so many things that are taking place right now, and there's ironies and paradoxes and controversies. It seems like I was listening to you and Dick. I mean, yeah, it just the issues seem to multiply every day.
Yeah, I mean, they all run on parallel tracks. Certain of these issues, you know, race ahead. This is like at a ballpark when they have the pre-programmed race where one entity. Or the sausage race at Milwaukee, the hot dog and the bratwurst and the Italian, and that one races ahead and then falls back, and the various stops. I mean, out of curiosity, Earl Mack, with all due respect to Earl, is he breeding much these days? Is he what? I mean, it's awfully. You know, I guess it.
I really don't know. He hasn't been very prominent in races, has he?
No, not that I have noticed for several years. I do think
that the idea generally is to. You know, among the quote-unquote leadership and the people behind Heise and all this stuff, I think the idea generally, and we've discussed this, is to shrink the game. And perhaps another ideology is, as the favorite line they use, internationally harmonize, which, you know, Eurocentric turf racing. And this kind of fits that agenda call. Earl's letter almost is part of that agenda to do that.
Well, and I've certainly talked about that for years, that it felt like, you know, some of the messaging was 8 tracks only and boutique meets only.
Yeah, and exactly. And then all this. Weather and turf only.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I and I you've heard me, and you and I have discussed this I mean, saying the quiet part out loud, so to speak, that it hasn't made to me a tremendous amount of sense how, you know, the breeding farms were all for this plan, when all it can mean is a reduction in their output and the demand for their stallions. I don't know. I suppose there's some economy of scale that would work, Sid. I don't know what it is. But I've been sort of, I've said this a number of times. We've said it to John Sakura, because John, you know, John certainly is trepidatious about a lot of this course of action, and mm-hmm. you know, and is has
well essentially what it ties in very much to the conversation that we went nostalgia. It's right now, it cuts two ways. There's a false sense of nostalgia to go back to a time that Chuck Simon put it really well in a piece, really didn't exist, but the nostalgic parts of it touches, which is hay, oats, and water. And then there's this part to, quote unquote, bring it in line with the rest of the world, subjugate the individuality of the American racing game, which is viewed as too tough, and make that part of a internationally harmonized group. So you basically get rid of the bottom, bring it to the top end, like you just said, internationally harmonize that. Perhaps, as Earl said, you know, we go to all weather, and basically take away this distinctly unique American brand of racing, because it's too much like, say, for their taste or public taste, too much like bullfighting. It's too much of a blood sport. Too many horses are dying. Dirt is too tough on them. Dirt horses require Lasix. It's too much of a speed game. Yada, yada, yada. So if you really step back and look at the messaging, the ideology, reduce everything, which means a lot of people will go out of business, but the top guys will stay in. And really, it's all about the top right now. The top guys own most of the horses. They own most of the stud farms. They own most of the broodmares. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And they want to craft it for their taste. They're done with this being a democratic game for everybody. They want to make this an elite game for themselves. And you got all these people on Twitter that buy into this messaging and yeah, let's do that. Without realizing what they're doing is going to take away that nostalgic game that everybody loves.
Well, the you and I very frequently, Sid, seem to be able to draw parallels how racing is a microcosm of society at large. And
exactly.
There's a certain percentage, a minority, just like when it comes to racing, that has got designs on the country, going back to a phony trope of an America that only exists in their minds, that never
exactly.
really, yeah,
exactly.
Certainly the one that they found, you know, nice and bright.
Right.
So, yeah, here it is again.
Here it is again.
Exactly. I mean, we haven't talked about it for a long time, and most of the stallions that, you know, actually found success, there's still there's still some of them, you know, that went on, you know, then others aged out or, you know, died like Kitten's Joy. Who else benefited, thinking back, Sid, to the synthetic surface? What lines and what families?
The Kitten's Joy was absolutely the number one beneficiary of it.
Right.
And he became the general leading sire by progeny earnings, with most of his progeny winning on all weather and turf. You have regional players like that Nureyev horse out in the Auerbach's horse out in California. Heat. What's his name?
Unusual Heat.
Unusual Heat. Yeah, you had regional stallions that popped up and took advantage of that. And Unusual Heat was a huge beneficiary of that in California. Ironically, the leading stallion right now in dirt, for example, Into Mischief, he made his name as a racehorse on all weather surfaces. That's yet another ironic twist of this thing. However, it's very obvious that when you do get to all weather, and Dick pointed out some pretty interesting anecdotes, that balls to the walls out of the gate speed part gets diminished, and that early speed and the ability to carry it is what characterizes the American dirt horse.
Right.
But it's what's made this horse so dominant globally. That's something that some people, breeders, stud farms in Kentucky would be loath to lose. So there's going to be pushback, definitely, from them. And what happens, Steve, is that you're going to get people who are allies on certain issues that are going to be vociferous enemies on others. Say these same people in Kentucky that were behind Heiser, for example, would be absolutely bitterly against switching to all weather if Heiser were to issue a dictum like that, or if there was a movement that way. So it's not like there's a monolith of agreement on every issue. Allies are going to turn into enemies on each particular issue as it affects them.
Well, that would be predictable and interesting. I don't know if it would come to that, if it's going to come to that. But what do you hear actually, Sid, on this? I mean, you talk to enough breeders and owners that.
Well, what I hear is basically what I was just telling you. Basically, stud farms do not want all weather tracks. They fought it. They got rid of it. They even got rid of it in Keeneland, even though the stats were so much better for fatalities. And they don't want to go back to it. So there's this very strong element there. And once you do get to say there was a groundswell and there was a movement and tracks started to revisit and rebuild all weather, I think you're going to get, it's coming to a head, because what Earl Mack is pointing out is that societal concerns for welfare and fatalities is, if you were to draw that to its conclusion, well, and this is their conclusion, which is, based on facts, it is true that all weather surfaces do reduce fatalities. And even though fatalities have been reduced drastically with all these new protocols in place, the fact of the matter is that dirt racing does tend to be the most, it is the hardest surface for a horse to race on. And, you know, most of our tracks are on dirt racing. And, you know, we don't really have the high level of protocol that we have for the Kentucky Derby, where they can take a horse like Forte out of a race just because, you know, he was off a little. Those horses that are running on other races and claiming races and stuff, I guarantee you they're much more off than Forte was, and they're allowed to run. You know, so you've got this groundswell heading towards a big collision. Societal concerns, which a lot of these groups pay lip service to, but when it comes to changing what they're used to, they draw the line and say, no, we just want to increase protocols so that we can reduce fatalities. So that's what I'm saying. There's just, you know what I'm saying? There's so much conflict among all the people that are involved, and nobody is there really at the top. There's no league office to say, look, this is what we need to do. You know, there's no voice. It's always one group that happens to be the loudest. At one time, we saw this with the Heise thing, where suddenly out of the blue, all these editorials were popping. even though it's the law.
Right.
You know?
Right. An uncoordinated assault.
Oh, my God. That's perfect. That is absolutely perfect. An uncoordinated assault. on whatever issue it is, that's how it is.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Let's call this guy. I was talking to a Jockey Club member the other day, and he was telling me, you know, they have guys in the Jockey Club that they've given membership to, you know, people that have been just desperate wanting to get into, and they give them to these guys. And this is a Jockey Club guy telling me this. And he said, you know, what we do is we use those guys to then go into the public and be the bag men, to go out and voice stuff, do stuff, you know, and they'll take the heat, they'll come down, but they listen to what we say. Go out and say this, or go out, get the word out this way, whatever, you know. But the top echelon always says kind of protected. And, you know, it's just it's head scratching the way in this day and age, you know, it's still a lot of backroom deals that, you know,
wow, that
full sway.
That description makes me think of the great scene in Godfather 2, buffers. Yeah, the family had a lot of buffers.
Buffers, that's it. But, bro, that's how a lot of these organizations operate. They are the mafia. You know, the mafia has several levels, you know, and you got captains, and then you've got the soldiers underneath them.
Yeah. Yep. It was the smart move. Tessio was always smarter. Sid, this was as always. We managed to
we tied it into the nostalgia of my mother-in-law's tuna for sandwich.
Well, and I respect that immensely, and I will I'll make a tuna fish reference. That, again, upstate New York folks and people from the region will appreciate. If you you go shopping at Cahoe's at the coat factory there in Cahoe's, and there was a lunchroom up on the top floor, and you'd take the, you know, they have the they had an elevator operator, freight elevator, take you up to the top floor. There was the lunchroom, and you didn't have to be an employee. If you were a customer, you could go through, and there'd be chicken salad, tuna salad, and I want to say ham salad on white bread in a wax paper bag. And
oh my God, that's perfect.
You could go down the line.
I can taste that. And I just want to add in, there's a place in Wichita called the Old Mill Sandwich Shop. They make the most incredible, like what you would imagine from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, liverwurst sandwich on beautiful white bread with lettuce and tomato and, you know, mustard and some red onion on it. I mean, it tastes like a different era.
Well, I know exactly the kind of place you're talking about, and I can tell you that when I made sales calls, when I was based in Kansas City, you could go every single small town you would drive through in the Midwest. They're all designed the same with a town square.
Yeah.
And the four-sided, you know, the four sides around a town square were usually, either a county administration building or a town hall in the center, and then all the shops and whatever around the square, and every one of those towns. And I had to call on restaurants. The whole western half of Missouri. And into Kansas, actually, as far out as Manhattan and Liberal and Junction City.
Yeah.
Where the first time in my life in Junction City, this is when I was with Procter & Gamble, I saw people with sidearms. Junction City, yeah. Kansas, guys wearing holsters and sidearms. I'd never in my life seen that. But in every one of those towns, there'd be a tea room. In the town square, and you—that's that kind of a sandwich with the crust cut off. You know,
yes, the crust cut off.
The exactly. the ladies who lunch, as they say. those tea rooms and the watercress sandwiches and I mean it literally was like time had stood still. In those places, and I called on all those restaurants. It was. Pan-fried chicken joints too in Missouri. I mean, especially Kansas City, Stroud's and those joints that beside the barbecue places. But wow, we've made everybody either hungry or mad.
Well, I would say both. I would say if there were some people listening, we certainly went higher up on the shit list, bro.
So they're hangry. In other words, they're hungry, yeah. And angry. All right,
they're hangry.
Instead, we might as well take another 2-3 minutes. I didn't even mention some of the Grade One winners from the weekend. They, you know, Defunded added the Gold Cup, big win. We talked to Peter Ertin on Monday or Tuesday. After the Shoemaker win, that's a big win for that Twirling Candy, for Exalted. And what a crazy story. I mean, here's a cigar in reverse, a horse that, goes to the grass and is like a monster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Twirling
John
Candy.
Right? John Henry did the same.
There
yeah.
you go. Well, but I tell you, Twirling Candy is if we're going to start adding more synthetic tracks, certainly Twirling Candy feels like a horse that could
absolutely
bridge the gap.
His horses run on everything,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he would make the cut. So Sid Fernando, everybody, Sire Watch, Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. And Sid, I won't see you at Belmont. That'd become something of a late model tradition, a Belmont visit,
yeah.
But we'll have to save that. And I appreciate all the frank thoughts and sentiments.
Absolutely, bro. We'll talk later.
Sid Fernando, everybody. Sire Watch Pedigree Folk is brought to you by Hill and Dale. And, of course, there's still, you know, there's still some breeding going on. Work Thoroughbred Consultants, 510-490-1111. You know, we're late enough into the year where, you know, you also probably got to start thinking about, you know, the bloodstock, you know, the late season bloodstock sale and making decisions about mares, right? You're going to, you know, you're going to call this one or that one. And, you know, this, of course, I mean, if this, if becomes a, you know, pervasive, essentially, and, you know, there has to be a industry-wide response. I mean, this would be something everybody would have to, you know, would have to adjust to. And I guess I'll reiterate what I said early on this morning, that nobody should preclude that if this does have to happen, that the previous experience with the synthetics, don't it shouldn't color everybody's approach to it and reaction to it, because it wouldn't be fair. The generation of surface now, I mean, is so superior to the absolute, you know, disastrous executions and products, essentially, that were foisted upon. I don't even think you can ridicule or indict the racetracks out west at the time. I Santa Anita, Hollywood, and Del Mar, they did, you know, they were reacting to what the CHRB said, and they could, what else could they have done except believe the merchandising, the way it was presented to them, of those products, Cushion Track, Poly Track, and Pro Ride. And they made, you know, there is also, of course, the critique, which would be fair, that, you know, why did the three racetracks, and actually Dick addressed that slightly when he mentioned, you know, the calls for the RFPs, requests for proposals, and the process that, you know, private company versus a quasi, you know, a nonprofit, et cetera, has to do to meet you know, legal requirements when it comes to hiring, you know, contracting an installation of that ilk. So that partially explains what, you know, how the decisions, you know, differed. But, you know, the fact that there were three different surfaces that didn't help. Four, really, if you count Golden Gate, right? Tapita. So, and of course, the most interesting thing that happened was the way in which Hollywood Park, in dealing with the problems that they had with, they had the Cushion Track, right? They had Cushion, Pro Ride was at Santa Anita, and Poly Track at Del Mar. But they started to mix natural material. And I don't know if it was the Sepulveda sand that comes from right there, actually, by the airport. But they started to mix natural materials with the Cushion Track. And if you remember, the Hollywood surface was really good, and it was very playable. It didn't have the variables and the maddening variables that Polytrack and the Pro Ride were dealing with at Del Mar and Santa Anita. You remember this? Yeah, the Hollywood Surface, they kept adding, you know, I don't know what the final percentage was of you know, natural materials to the synthetic portion. But I that was an interesting variable that came to pass. And I can't you know what else I can't remember? When Hollywood closed, did anybody utilize that mix for anything? You could write a book about that whole episode. But anyway, the point is, if this has to happen, it would be a different scenario, and would be, I mean, there would still be the requisite recalibrating for all of us as players and everything else, but it would not be as harrowing and as off-putting, I think, as the first go-around was. So, just a thought. We'll see. We'll see how. I have, you know, one question. One follow-up I didn't throw at Sid was, and I've said this out loud a few times. I mean, who exactly are we answering to? Supposedly, I mean, I got my own feeling with it, which is I don't think there's anybody specific that we're beholden to. I mean, the people keep throwing around the social license thing. I'm sorry. My answer to that continues to be X number of livelihoods are going to continue to outweigh the concern and the alleged concern of the outside world, quote unquote. I'm sorry. Hundreds of thousands of professional lives and livelihoods and families that that's what animals are on Earth to help sustain, whether it's the food system or any other related. I'm sorry, human lives are always going to take priority, and that it mystifies me that that's not part of our answer. I mean, everybody loves Yellowstone, right? That everybody loves the Yellowstone and the depiction of rancher life. What you think? what do you think is sustaining that those livelihoods? That's, as I said the other day, that's commercial slaughter of animals. by the tens of thousands on a daily basis. We've got our animal partners that we absolutely adore and appreciate in every possible way, and it's unbelievable that there'd be that there's this alleged uproar. It sure feels to me like it's a small portion of society that's being amplified by people with a completely different agenda. I just don't get it. Who are we supposedly answering to with all of this hand-wringing and recriminations of racetrack organizations and the industry participants. Let's take this break, and Seth Merrow is going to join us, and more. All right? I think Bill McLean is going to visit this hour as well. Looking forward to it. A long time. Horseman. Speaking of Golden Gate and Tapita. Hour three at the races. Stay with us. You never know what's coming.
XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Friesian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is moving like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown Triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents